Well, I'll tell you what, potatoes are certainly a staple for many of our meals here in Wisconsin. Very popular vegetable. What you might not know is that there's a global gene bank for potatoes. It's a worldwide gene bank located right here in our state. We're going to be talking about it today. And its importance, and the importance of potatoes. Answer your questions about spuds here as we visit with a couple of staffers from the Peninsular Agriculture Research Station just outside of Sturgeon Bay, where it's located. John Bamberg is USDA Ag Research Service geneticist, professor in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. Max Martin, our other guest, is program manager of the Gene Bank, and he oversees the day-to-day operations of the Gene Bank. He's also an academic staff member in the Department of Horticulture with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Max and John are joining us from our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Green Bay today. John, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. And Max Martin, thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thank you for calling us and letting us be on the air.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've been looking forward to this program because I don't know a whole lot about this, the gene bank, and I suspect a lot of other people are in the same boat as me. So give us a sense of the scale of potato consumption, maybe worldwide.
Potatoes are the number three crop for human nutrition in the world. First is rice, and then wheat, and then potatoes. And the country that grows the most potatoes, I think, will surprise you, Larry. Do you have a clue?
Let's see. What would be the... It wouldn't be the U.S.? I mean, man, we produce a lot of spuds.
No, it's China.
China!
China produces and consumes more potatoes than the next three largest producers and consumers in the world.
Oh, my goodness. Where do we fall?
Where does the U.S.? About the fifth country as far as production of potatoes in the world.
Eastern Europe is big, too. They eat a lot more potatoes there than we do.
Oh, what's our consumption of potatoes per year, annual?
Something around 130 pounds. A year, a little less maybe.
Man, I ate 130 pounds of potatoes this past year. I bet a lot of it's in French fries in this country.
That is correct.
What is it, Max, over 60% or so now?
Yeah, it's about 50-60% in potato in French fries, and then if you add chips into that, it gets up to 70%.
Wow. I tell you what, David and Sabin has a question that kind of goes along with what we're talking about here, sort of the history and so forth. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I've heard the story that potatoes originated in the Andes and moved to Europe with the Spanish people, and then it wasn't until later that they came to North America. I'm so interested in finding out if that's true, and if so, who and when took the potatoes from Europe to North America.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's see. John Bamberg, do you want to take a shot at that, or Max?
I don't. This is John. I don't know the exact history of it, but it was early days. And, you know, at that time, of course, with the discovery of new civilizations and continents, people were exchanging those kinds of crops. And the history is kind of foggy. There are some indications that maybe some trading ships came up the Pacific coast too, even earlier, but it's definitely not a new world, or it's not a old world crop, and it came here from Latin America by way of Europe.
That's how it got here. Okay. All right, thanks David for calling. Appreciate it. It's interesting to me that something of You wonder kind of how did it get started? How, you know, who was the first person to try a potato to eat? Where'd that come from? You wish you knew, wouldn't you?
The wisdom on that is that there was a center of diversity of all the, you know, all the wild weedy things, and you can see then in the area between Peru and Bolivia that they started having domesticated types. So we assume that That's where the first domestication took place.
Oh, and Max Martin, maybe you can talk about the gene bank. What's the purpose of the gene bank, and how did it come to be in Wisconsin? So I'll give you a two-parter there.
Well, the gene bank started when a lot of people from the universities would go down to South America to collect true seeds down there, take them back to their universities, use them, and then they'd be gone. And in the 1950s and 40s, a professor in Madison said, you know, we really should have a central storehouse for these, a place where if you go down there, you can send some seeds here, they'll be maintained, they'll be increased, and we can test those true seeds for disease resistance, and they'll be available to the world rather than them just being lost.
That is very, so that started, so that professor, whoever that professor was, talked somebody in, who was it?
Dr. Bob Hogus.
Bob Hogus.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I knew Bob Hogus when he was a dean at the University of Wisconsin in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. So
yes.
I did not know that Bob was responsible for that. Gab, go ahead.
We have a building. The building we work in is named after Bob.
So. He was the first project leader of the gene bank, actually, back in the early days.
And so the funding came, where did the funding originally come from? Where does it come from now?
It was originally a Wisconsin deal, but quickly became a multi-state cooperation of the ag experiment stations in the Midwest states. And then it's been for many years now a national program. So we're funded by a cooperation of all the ag experiment stations across the country. That's one component, and then USDA also, Agricultural Research Service of USDA, is another partner. So we have kind of a three-way partnership between USDA, the multi-state cooperative, and Wisconsin, per se.
What kind of research goes on there? I was looking it over, and it's some fascinating stuff.
The idea is, I think that we should do a little bit of everything. You look at any particular research project on campus and you probably see specialization. We try to be more generalist because germplasm applies to everything you'd want to do with potatoes. So everything from culinary traits to disease resistances and everything in between, so pathology and entomology. So we have to kind of be generalists. So we're kind of jacks of all trades and maybe not experts on any, but in that way we can serve everybody who uses germplasm.
Roger in Lone Rock has a question for you. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Most of us know about planting potatoes where we actually plant the tuber, but you've mentioned seed, and I know that potatoes will make seed, but how is the genetic material stored at the bank?
We have about 5,000 collections of true seed. So, like you said, most of the potatoes that get planted in your garden are planted by tubers, but we maintain about 5,000 accessions of true seed. So that's how most of it's maintained. It's stored in a 0 degrees Fahrenheit refrigerator, and some of them, you'll get germ even after 30, 40 years up to 90-95% if you maintain them well.
Very interesting. So it's pretty much all seed then that's stored.
Yeah, we have like I said, the 5,000 as true seed, and then we also maintain about 800 as tissue culture in test tubes.
You can imagine that seeds have a lot of advantages. They're small, yeah. They last for a long time, and they're easy to put in an envelope and send someplace.
Oh, yeah.
They also don't carry the virus load that a tuber will.
Yeah, I can see that. But obviously, you're not going to store that at those test tubes at zero.
Not if you want to keep them alive. they're kept at about 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
And pretty constant, I would imagine. Constant, yeah. Alex in Beaver Dam, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me so much. My question is, I heard from a friend of mine that back in the early 1800s that the Irish would just literally eat a diet of just potatoes. So I guess I was wondering if there is enough vitamins and minerals and, you know, different stuff like that in a potato that you can actually just subside on that? And if so, you know, is that still the case today? Have potatoes changed at all in their minerals? You know, so I guess that's my question.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some studies on that, and the conclusion seems to be that potatoes and a little bit of milk is pretty complete. Potato has not a lot of protein, but a very complete protein. And going back to the comment about the Irish and people who, like the Irish and some Highland Peruvian people, who eat almost exclusively potatoes, you know, it speaks to how palatable they really are. Can be eaten in all different forms, and yeah, a lot of good nutrition in potatoes.
Now, is it true, and I've always heard that it was, you know, that sort of outer quarter of an inch or so and the skin is where most of the nutrition lies. Is that true? What do you think, John?
Yes and no. For some things, like potassium, there's more. Calcium, there's more in the skin. More fiber there, But you know, you also get any contaminants that you might be worried about are more going to be more on the skin. So,
yeah. So there's always a always a little downside.
That's right.
Perhaps
or the greenness too. You know, that you might be worried about if you get some green on your potatoes. That's on the outside, obviously.
Yeah, but I tell you what, there's nothing like a baked potato. I'm thinking, here we are close to getting dinner time or lunchtime here.
That's right.
There is nothing like a baked potato, and not one where you put the aluminum foil around, because then you're not even baking it. Then you're steaming it. But I love a baked potato that's baked just right.
Potato flavor.
Oh, man, oh, man, oh, man. And the skin on one of those is kind of one of my favorite things. John Bamberg and Max Martin with us. To talk about potato seed banks and the lovely potato. Yeah, they'll be with us till 12:30. Stick around. Well, whether it's fried or baked or mashed or boiled, potatoes are certainly a staple in a lot of our meals. And no surprise, many of the ethnic groups that have made Wisconsin their home had potatoes as mainstays of their diets. But what you might not know, what we've really been talking about, is that there's a worldwide global gene bank for potatoes right here in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here, happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We have a couple of staffers from the Peninsular Agriculture Research Station just outside of Sturgeon Bay to talk about the fascinating work that goes on there. Have you heard about the potato gene bank? Have a question about potatoes? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And we'll be back with our guests right after the news. Potatoes are such a common element of our diet that sometimes it's kind of easy to overlook them, I think. And yet they are a key part of our world food supply. And because of that, it's important that the genetic diversity and the health of potatoes is monitored and maintained. And guess what? That happens right here in Wisconsin at a potato gene bank that serves the world. Larry Mueller here talking about that potato gene bank today with a couple of people who are working right there. John Bamberg is USDA Agriculture Research Service geneticist, professor in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. And John, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Good to be here.
And Max Martin, program manager of the Gene Bank, and he oversees the day-to-day operations of the bank, and he is also an academic staff member in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. Max, great to have you with us as well.
Glad to be here, Larry.
We have a lot of people with questions for you on the phone, so I'm going to go right to the phones. Matt's been waiting a while for Madison. Matt, hi, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon. I'm a small market gardener, and I've always been curious about how public germplasm banks are handled when it comes to private industry. Most of what's available to us in the public isn't developed by public institutions anymore. So what happens with the germplasm that is either hybridized or improved by private entities? Is their effort lost, or do they recontribute back into this germplasm
Yeah, good question. John Bamberg, you want to try it?
We certainly receive things from anybody, so if you have something to contribute that's a really great new selection and it's freely available, we'll certainly take it and keep it. Those kinds of decisions are made, you know, by us mostly, but also some by our administration. We're actually, you know, the clearinghouse for anything that's of interest, not just really exotic stuff, and not just things that are for breeders, let's say.
So if Matt phoned you or made some sort of request for a particular type or a particular seed of potato, for example, you might be able to help him out as on the other side of it here.
Of course, but the thing is, we only deal in little samples to get you started. So
yeah,
it's not an alternative to a seed catalog, for example, because we'll only send you one test tube or one small packet of seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Are the potato cultivars, you know, like if I'm looking for a specific disease resistance, like if I have problems with scab, like I've got an excellent potato, but I'd like to cross it with one that has excellent scab resistance. Is that typically how it's done, or how do you categorize the potatoes, and how does one break them down to find out what's available?
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of that data on our website, but probably what you'd want to do is call us and get some advice. Particularly, we'd probably refer you to other breeders around the country that are working on those kinds of things that have, you know, particular insight into what you would do. And they might even have better materials. We don't keep everything, obviously. There's a whole lot of germplasm out in the various breeding programs and state seed certification labs.
And you have a website, right?
Oh yeah.
And what's the website?
Well, just Google potato and germplasm, and you'll find it.
Potato and germplasm. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. There you go, Matt. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And Betty in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Betty.
Hey, this is so exciting. You have so many. I have so many different questions. I used to imagine going down to Peru and being able to climb up and see the farmers growing their potatoes with all the wild varieties still growing next to the ones they were harvesting. And I was wondering, first question, are you still having people sending up new varieties from Peru, and how broad is the gene bank for potatoes? I mean, I get the impression that there are a lot more potato varieties still available than corn varieties. Am I making sense?
There's about 5,000 varieties recognized in the world, and 3,000 plus are all from the Andes region. And we do still bring varieties in from Peru, from the International Potato Center there. So we get people that request them. There's certain disease resistance or color or some trait that they saw in them that they're interested in having us bring them in. And so we do still bring clones in from there.
Well, that's cool. The other question was, how often do you grow them out and recollect the seeds? Or do they just sit there for...
We make a decision on whether we need to regenerate the true seed collection by if the germination goes low, or if we're just running low on seeds. If we get a lot of requests for them, we can actually run low on seeds. And so that's how the decision is to regenerate the seeds.
Wow.
And then that regeneration occurs inside of a greenhouse or screen house, and it's controlled pollination. We do what we call sib mating. We grow out 20, 21 plants, let them get to the flowering, gather pollen from all the open flowers, and then pollinate them.
Oh, cool. Is that done on site, or are they farmed out to different greenhouses? Or
It's done on site.
Wow.
If you drive by the research station, you'll see there's three greenhouses there, and those are usually full of potatoes, mostly wild potatoes.
When I was in school, we visited you at one time, but that was so long ago, I hardly remember it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate the call. And Tim in Fairchild's been waiting a while here, too. Tim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, Larry, thanks for taking my call. I listen to you all the time.
Appreciate it.
I mainly have... a comment and probably a question. I was involved in the potato industry mainly all my adult life. I'm retired now. But so I've been to the station up in Sturgeon Bay. And then the Wisconsin Research Farm up at Three Lakes is amazing. But I was going to ask your guests if they've ever been out to the Frito-Lay Research Farm up near Rhinelander, where they have literally hundreds of varieties that they have planted that they test for disease resistance and everything else. And then when they find a variety, whether or not it meets those qualifications, is it edible? So that was just my question and comment.
Thanks, Tim. And I don't know, John, you want to take it? John Bamberg?
Well, yeah, Frito-Lay is one of the few private breeders in the business. But, of course, Wisconsin itself has a state breeding program that does exactly the same thing. And a number of other programs around the country do that, state as well as federal. So that's exactly the kind of business that they're in. But that's at the very end of the process. So they're making commercial things that are ready to be planted. We're contributing that by kind of providing the raw materials. So okay. We work with all those breeding programs, Frito-Lay, Simplot, and all the other state breeding programs.
Very cool. Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it very much. You know, Judith, our producer, we were talking about potatoes. She was in Bolivia several years ago, and Americans and Brits, alike, were there and all called the tubers they saw and ate potatoes. And the Bolivians thought they were so funny because of all the varieties that were lumping. They were lumping under the name of potato, whereas different to the Bolivians as broccoli or cauliflower or artichokes or whatever are different to us.
Yeah, the story I've heard is that when a lot of Latin American people come here, they say, oh, we're so sad because you don't have potatoes here. And I say, what are you talking about? Well, you don't have the diversity of colors and shapes and flavors that we have. So,
yeah, you can find them all at your place, though.
Find a lot of them here.
You bet. Listener Ted wondered about the role that Luther Burbank had in the field of potato research. Can either of you comment on that, Max or John?
Yeah, he had a big role. We have a potato variety called Russet Burbank.
Yeah.
And despite being crossed by Luther back in 1874, it still holds about 50% of the potato varieties planted in the U.S., 50% of the potatoes planted in the U.S. are to Russet Burbank. So it's still a very popular variety that he selected.
And that was when? Back in what?
1874.
Wow. And it's still right there. Man, oh, man. Caller Jessica recommended the book Indian Givers, How the Indians of the Americas Transformed the World. Jack Weatherford wrote it. Either of you read that? It's an amazing description of the variety of potatoes in the Andes.
Yes. He makes that, he quotes that the idea that more value has come from potatoes that came from Latin America than all the gold that the Spaniards shipped out of there. So that's an interesting concept.
Well, and Eric emailed us from Walworth County, and he visited Peru last summer, and he learned that there were about 1,400 varieties in the country, with 800 varieties in the Sacred Valley that you guys were talking about earlier. It's Cusco or Cusco, is it, alone? In the last couple of years, a remote valley turned up two additional varieties still grown by those families. The sizes and colors abound from pea size and up, from blue to yellow and so forth. And the USA may have a few general-purpose potatoes commercially, but the diversity in Peru is really wonderful and unique. And you guys would agree with that, I bet.
Yeah, and you have to define your terms there. What do you mean by variety? Because you could make a cross, and you could plant 1,000 seedlings, and you could pick the one you want, and that would be a variety. And there are all shades between that and something that's been published and is known around the world as a certain name. So there are all different kinds of definitions for variety, but you're almost, really, you'd say it's unlimited in Peru, where you might grow something that's that's known by its shape and color, but maybe the same or just slightly different than another seedling.
And Jim in Black River Falls emailed in and said, this program reminds me of Dr. Henry Darling of the UW Plant Pathology Department. He was crucial to this subject and should be mentioned. And John Bamberg, I'm sure you're familiar with the name of Henry Darling.
Well, disease things are you know, very important to what we're doing. Disease, stress, and pests, all those kinds of things are on the production end. So, I mean, you can imagine that that's a big part of making the crop better is to try to fight those kinds of things. So, yeah, it's an important part of what we do. Dealing with people that are pathologists and entomologists and all those different kinds of more production end.
Yeah, yeah. Judy in St. Germain wondered, what's that green layer that you find when you're peeling potatoes?
Well, that's chlorophyll, but it's also the problem with it is that it's also where the bitterness is being generated. I think they're two separate pathways, but you know the common wisdom is, if you see green, you probably shouldn't eat that part. Potato's a stem anyway, you know. People say, oh, it's underground, it must be a root. But no, it's just a stem. So when you put light on it, typically, you're going to get the greening up of the stem. But we have something really interesting going on in that regard, and that is that we found some just in the last few years that don't green. So the question being answered right now is, are they also not bitter if they're exposed to light?
So there's some research going on about that.
Yeah, and it's an example of just, you know, how anything you want to look for, you could possibly find it in the exotic material, in the wild species. You've got about 100 species to look in, so there's everything is there, it seems like. Even something so unusual as that, these potatoes don't get green when you put light on them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was in Orlando and looking at a project where they were growing sweet potatoes in the air, and the potatoes were being literally they were raised up above ground. This is something that Disney's doing, or at least reporting on it. And so they weren't even using dirt; they were growing them right out of the ground. They looked pretty interesting.
So were they spraying the roots with a mist?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Just hydroponically growing them?
Yep.
A lot of the certified seed that comes out of the state starts its first year as hydroponics, growing essentially no soil, just growing in a liquid that's flowing. The roots are flowing by them.
John in Madison has a comment. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Larry, you always have great programs and wonderful guests.
Thank you.
Being Norwegian, I have to comment on the fact that we are always teased about having our food is always white, and that's potatoes. I grew up eating potatoes all the time. And lefse, and there's also aquavit, the liquor out of Norway. But my question is, the Doomsday Vault up in Svalbard, northern Norway, has millions of seeds now of many varieties. I'm curious as to why the potato vault, whatever you want to call it, is in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. I'm just curious.
Mm-hmm.
That brings up a great point, that actually we are not the corresponding gene bank like Svalbard is, because we have our own in this country like base collection, long-term gene bank, and that's in Fort Collins, Colorado. So the place that's kind of the vault is one central place for the U.S., and our gene bank is called a working collection. So we actively grow and distribute to anybody that asks for the material. It's a little bit different than like a long-term safe for germplasm.
Yeah.
I think an interesting point there is that, you know, we're talking potato gene bank today, but if you go on the USDA GRIN website, you'll see that there's gene banks for this for all the crops and the herbs, everything. There's a gene bank someplace in the U.S. that saves these and distributes them around the world.
Very cool.
There's one near Decorah, Iowa, too, I believe.
Decorah, Iowa...
That's a Seed Savers Exchange. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'll bet. That's a huge operation.
Yeah.
We deal with them, too, and that's another interesting point, that we don't necessarily try to keep everything ourselves. Max does a lot of networking with places like that to make sure that, you know, it's available if we don't have it, per se.
And it's probably, you know, in some ways, it's probably not a bad idea to have things spread out a little bit. I mean, and you know, there's got to be a bank somewhere, but at the same time, you know, some cataclysmic event occurring at right, you know, an earthquake or whatever, right over the one spot where all this stuff is collected and stored could be a disaster.
Yeah, that's why everything we have is backed up at NSSL in Fort Collins, Colorado. And all the other gene banks have their stuff backed up there as well. So if something happened at Fort Collins, we would have it at the active site. If something happens here, we can always go back to Fort Collins and
get it. Yeah, I mean, here it could be some enormous tornado or something come through and just nail the place. And but you've got you can go back. You'd be able to go to Fort Collins and just sort of replenish.
Yep.
Yeah, that is wonderful. What about anything with, you know, we've got weather changes. What about our ability to react to this? Like, you know, we've got last year's drought, in fact, global warming. Are these kinds of things on the radar as far as the gene bank is concerned?
Absolutely. That's a hot topic, you know, that all these stresses and just unpredictability per se is making people say, hey, what kind of tools are there to breed new potatoes that will be more resistant to those things? We can't get water. Can we have a drought-resistant potato? And if we can't get decent weather that's cool enough, you know, can we get something that'll tuberize even in hot conditions? So, yeah, there's a lot of interest in that now due to climate change issues.
And a caller wanted to know if you do genetic modification of potatoes.
I'm assuming they're talking GMOs or and we don't maintain any of the GMOs at the potato research station. We just don't keep them there, don't have them there.
So it's just not something you're going to get involved in.
Correct.
Tends to be proprietary too, so if it can't be freely distributed,
we
don't tend to have those things.
Yeah, that's a very good point. What about let's talk a little bit more about some current projects that you may be working on. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you can imagine that the things that we do are centered on, you know, the task that we have. So, like, for example, we need to figure out how to cross different species and how to make seeds germinate well and those kinds of things. So we do a lot of technical research, and that also includes trying to get a handle on where the genetic diversity really is. We'd like to prioritize our work based on where the richest sources of genetic diversity are. So we're doing a lot of molecular marker work to try to see how different populations respond to the techniques that we do. And then, of course, the kind of things we've been talking about so far, just basic evaluation for all different kinds of traits, disease and stress and pests and cultural traits and greening, things like that. Particularly, we're interested in, at the gene bank, in having a niche in nutritional traits, because just such huge impact from potato nutrition, seeing that it's eaten so much.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we come up with good quality foods. You know, the better food you got, the better the more healthy your population is going to be, and just sort of the better off we all are through this kind of research. Guys, I want to thank you so much. Been a real pleasure to have you visit with us about the potato gene bag, something I had not. Didn't know anything about. Now I know a whole lot more, and I really appreciate you taking time to be with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, I appreciate it very much. Don Bamberg is USDA Ag Research Service geneticist, professor in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. Max Martin, also a staff member at the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and program manager of the Gene Bank, and oversees the day-to-day operations. And you go online to the Facebook page, I believe we have a link to the operation. You can learn some more about the bank. And thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it. We'll talk fitness tomorrow, among other things, and airfare. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.